It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And if Adam sounds like he's a little distant, he is one more time. You're back here next week, right, Adam, in studio?
I promise I will be back in the studio next week.
Oh, good, because, you know, just not exactly lonely, but, you know, once in a while, kind of fun to look over and see somebody making faces at you when you say something really stupid.
Yeah, it's a really busy month, but
I
am returning.
Yeah, but you know that feeling, right?
Oh, I do. I know it.
I thought maybe so. Anyway, to our regulars, thanks for being back and always being with us, because you know it's why we get up and do this all the time. And if you're new, then stick around for a while. And if you want some other new people for the ever-growing ranks that listen to us, tell your friends. That's why we make it easy to remember by always reminding you it's Saturday morning at 10. I have a PSA, quickly. Actually, it's partly because of me, but Angela and Howard didn't get around to giving the answer to their trivia question because I was giving them hand signals and stuff. The answer is 90%. The question, it would do this in Jeopardy order, how much have refis fallen in the, I guess it was this year or the last 12 months or something like that. But can you imagine that? The people who are involved in refinancing for a living, and Howard did mention this too, they're not having a real good time right now, and I don't see much incentive for that to change because rates are not going down, and in order to make a valid case to do a refi at today's rates, you got to be holding a mortgage that's so awful that either you couldn't get it refied because of your credit or something like that, or you were sound asleep for the past 5 years, and there just can't be many of those out there, in my opinion. So, you know, if you did it in the last few years and you're down in the 2.5%, 3%, 3.5%, or even 4% range, pat yourself on the back, kick back, and enjoy it, because you won't have another chance for a while yet. So, anyway.
You know, I can only think of a few reasons why people would even do a refi right now. One of them you mentioned is if you have a really old mortgage with a higher rate. The other one being if you are in desperate need of taking out some equity and don't want to do a HELOC or some other method, I guess that would be another potential reason. But not a whole lot of reasons out there to touch a refi these days.
Yeah, and there might be some out there, too, where they're holding 30 years and they know they're only going to be in town another 3, 4, 5 years, whatever. And they might want to try to take advantage of a rate on a short term
an arm that
might be low enough now that it would be below their rate. But even then, you got to justify closing costs to do something like that, and it's just not that easy to do. Now, I've been over this several times with Christine Kennedy, and the stats on the refis are a pretty tough hurdle to get over.
Definitely.
Yep. Anyway, on to more fun topics. How many times have you heard me procrastinate because I didn't want to talk about the market lately? Almost every time. Well, not today. Today we want to talk about the market, so hit it.
Yeah, it was finally a bit of a reprieve from all the selling, and it was long overdue, but I think that, well, we did see a nice week. I would not jump on the everything's going to get better train. So I think it this week comes with an asterisk. We were into extreme oversold levels last week, and it was almost inevitable that we saw some sort of bounce, but I'm not diving back in head first yet. So just be cautious out there. I know it felt good to finally see some green on the screen, but this thing, we just hit a bear market a week ago or 2 weeks ago now, and just be real cautious going forward. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Absolutely. Anybody who moves too fast is likely to get burned. If you want to be nibbling around the edges and making some tactical things, that's even hard nowadays. If you look at what worked during the bad times or what worked less bad or whatever. And some of those things, like if you're in the commodity indexing, the glory days aren't holding up very long, and that's the truth. So I don't know. Anyway, we do have a phone call, and we have enough time to take it, so let's do. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning, gentlemen.
What's cooking?
One more thing someone can do while listening to y'all.
Yeah, what's that?
I drove over to Commonwealth to the hazardous waste dump and finally got rid of a bunch of junk that my wife was wanting me to get out of the garage.
Well, that sounds so useful.
It was a win-win, and now I'm fully dedicated to listening to y'all. But I do have one exception to your thought about refinances.
Shoot.
Yes. The traditional world has fallen dramatically because everybody's focused on, let's take my 4% loan and get to 3%, 5% loan to get to 3%, whatever.
Yep.
But a lot of people are realizing today in my world,
which is the reverse, yeah.
People who've had a home for a good while and realizing, what do you mean my house is worth $700,000 now?
True.
And all of a sudden they realize, oh, what can I do to complement my retirement plan?
And there you go.
And use it as it goes. So that is the one and possibly only exception these days.
Well, somebody's got a benefit in every economic condition, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. But I do have the question for you is this. I know that you're going to get into the economics, but if you would stretch it just a little bit beyond the equities world, into the movement of the 10-year, which looked like a NASA rocket taking off for a while.
Yeah,
and now it looks like the leftover tank that is of spent fuel falling dramatically for this week. So,
maybe that was the soft landing the Fed's been looking for.
If it's something that our Fed or our federal government has been looking for, I'm saying watch out for that.
Good plan.
Thank you Adam, all so much.
Sure. Adam's pretty knowledgeable on these things, so I'll see how he gets through it in the balance of the market wrap, which will take a little while yet. Appreciate the call. Have a good one.
Yeah, good question about the 10-year, Marshall. I believe I said probably a month ago that I thought it had shot up way too fast. I said it several weeks in a row, and we just saw it moving like crazy. It doubled, basically, in the span of just a few months. And I think it was inevitable, much like getting a bounce in the market this week. I think it was inevitable that we saw it either level off or even come back down a bit, just because when things get overheated like that, that tends to be the natural reaction to those situations. So I believe I saw mortgage rates drop pretty substantially this week, too. I think it's probably just a blip, and I think they will go back up as interest rates rise. But I'm sure that might be for some of you who are still in the housing market and looking to mortgage.
Yeah, you're getting some cracking up again. You might want to, during this break, call in again and see what we can do. Phil is on the line, but I don't have time to take it. So, Phil, can you hang on, and we'll take you right after the break. And we've only got about 30 seconds, and that's not going to do us much good. But briefly, in the 30 seconds, I think the Supreme Court did something just absolutely spectacular this week, and they should be praised up one side and down the other, because no longer do New Yorkers with carry permits have to leave their guns at home when they walk the streets of danger in New York City. How about that? I hope I fooled you, because I'm not going to do the rest of them. All right, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Van Lee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Lee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Lee.
And I'm Adam Van Wey.
That sounds pretty good this time. How about that? All right, we do have a trivia question, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Most of you probably remember a huge data breach just back in 2019, where Capital One had millions of customers affected, and the information that went out included such things as your name and Social Security number. It was a bad one, and they were fined by the government $80 million. But Capital One also settled with their affected customers. I want to know how many dollars each for the customers was that settlement worth? And now, good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Team Gold Financial Gurus of Northeast Florida, Adam and Stephen, the Van Wees.
Well,
I want to
thank you
on behalf of all of us and your great listening that's increasing every Saturday, crew, and your team for all the good that you do every day. I'm an old timer, and I think I have you by some years, but I grew up with financial as a teenager, didn't know what it was. And I was left a lot of good stuff in trust funds and whatnot. And just to listen to you two, and even when you're one, when the one of you is absent, it's accepted because things happen. But it's just unbelievable the knowledge that you share from your heart on everything. And it shows, believe me, on your broadcast. So that's a five-star compliment for you guys.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm going to take a guess.
Yeah.
And can you repeat it, if you don't mind, the trivia question?
I miss that.
Could you repeat the trivia question?
Oh, sure.
Again?
When Capital One settled with its customers for the data breach, how many dollars per customer was the settlement?
Okay, I don't know for sure, and I don't Google my answers, so I'm going to say about $300 each.
Well,
I'm probably all.
Yep, you're high, but that gives us a bracket.
Yeah, because there probably was maybe 3 or 4 million customers, you know. So, and I'm going to leave it to someone else to call in. And you are the best of the best, and don't ever forget it. Live life, love life, take care of your financial, which you always advise us to. And hopefully my health will allow me to call in next Saturday. God bless you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. We look forward to it. Thanks for the call. Okay, Adam, you want to carry on again? I'd like to have you address this while you're doing it. Are we in a recession? The question we ask week after week. And if not, will we be in one sometime in the next year or two?
I think that we are. I'm not 100% sure, and we won't know for a few more weeks, but it is one of the weirdest recessions I've ever seen, if we are in one, because things are busy, people are vacationing and going out to eat, and they're fully employed. And if the numbers come out next month and say that the second quarter saw a contraction in GDP, that would put us in a recession. But it would definitely be the strangest recession in my lifetime. If we're not in a recession, I think that the chances of being in one in the next 18 months are, gosh, I would go as high as 75-80%, and I would put that squarely on the shoulders of the Fed. I think that the way that they are navigating this, these policy decisions that they're making, much like they do almost every time, I think they're going to overshoot on raising rates, and I think that they are going to slow the economy enough to put us in a recession. So yeah, I guess.
So you're saying the Fed isn't going to get it right this time?
I mean, this time could be different, but it's not.
Yeah, so, what are the odds? This goes back, well, let's say in a post-Volcker era, has the Fed ever gotten it right?
No. Never.
And that you didn't have to think about that very long.
No, it's something I've been thinking about a lot, almost every day. So yeah. I definitely am concerned about that. There's not much we can do about it. It's well out of our control.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if we are in a recession, I think that's almost good news, just because that means we would be closer to getting out of a recession, and the market would be closer to rebounding, in my opinion, than if the recession is coming up in 12 months. So I'm not saying I'm hoping that we are. I just wouldn't be surprised at all if in a few weeks the second quarter GDP numbers come out and it says that we are.
Yeah, the group that determines and then make the official call on whether or not we're in a recession, they're called something like the National Economic My Aren't I Smarter Than You Group, and they are allowed to manipulate things like the real versus nominal dollars and that sort of thing. In other words, they have the opportunity to manipulate it, and I'm not going to say that they do or will. I'm saying they have the ability, and that might just lead to some real interesting number like zero. And I don't know if you remember, Adam, that you're not maybe not old enough to remember this stuff, but at the end of the Clinton era when they were turning it over to George W. Bush, and Bush and Cheney were calling it a recession, but the economists did not, because they did not have two consecutive negative GDP growth quarters, according to them. They had a negative one, followed by a 0.1 growth, followed by another negative, and they called it a non-recession. You know, I know, the world knows, we were in a recession, period. So regardless of the technical things, now if it comes out 1.5%, 2% growth, fine, I'll eat my words and say, good, we avoided it for now. And the only way we can get back in it now would be either another catastrophe, either Biden's, we're preparing for number two pandemic, which just, of course, BS. But or if there's an escalation of the war with Russia and things like that. But under normal economic circumstances, I think if the Fed starts to realize it, and I see glimmers of hope that they are, there's a possibility we could slide out of this thing. And that's kind of a gigantic equivocation, because it's so difficult to predict. But anyway, carry on.
Yeah, so one thing that has me concerned is that we are seeing a slowdown in commodity, or actually a reversal in commodity prices and right. bond yields. And you may ask, why is that a bad thing? Because commodities are too high and bond yields are too high. Well, the problem with that is a lot of it is caused by falling demand. And that is the type of economic activity that can put us into recession. So if we're seeing falling demand and rates are falling because investors think that federal banks around the world are tightening too much and they're going to put us into a global recession, that is not good news. So I do want commodities to come down, but I don't want it to fall so far, because there's just the demand just goes away because we do go into a recession. So it's a really, really fine line that the Fed and other Feds around the world are walking, and I am less and less convinced every day that they can get us out without causing some real damage to the economy.
So they've got to get more of the recently printed money. 40% of the money in this country was printed in the last couple of years, and they have got to take some of that out of there by doing the reverse QE, but they've got to get money out of the economy, because that creates an artificial demand, and that money is used for something, and as it gets used, what it's buying you is more expensive stuff, because the underlying demand isn't there. But when the producers can see that they can get more money for something, they're not dumb, and they're going to raise the prices just like that. That scares me, too.
Speaking of demand, with gas prices where they are, you would think that we'd be seeing record demand, which would be causing those prices, but that's not true.
Nope.
If you look at U.S. demand for U.S. refined gasoline, we're at actually below the levels of 2017, 2018, and 2019. But the one thing that hasn't fallen is foreign demand for U.S. refined gasoline. Right. So Europe is actually buying a lot of our supply, as they no longer can buy from Russia for obvious reasons. So they're buying a bunch of U.S. gas, and that is really causing our gas prices to skyrocket, as you may have noticed. However, over the last couple of weeks, it's come down from over $120 per barrel to about $107. I think it bottomed out around
$105, I think it closed this week. Maybe it wasn't quite close when I saw that, but yeah, substantial decline.
Yeah, I looked at it this morning. It said 107, okay. But it's been hovering in that 104 to 107 range for the week. So it's definitely come off its peak, but without further fall, without less of a demand, you're not going to see that price come down much farther. So if Europe keeps consuming our U.S. refined gasoline, we could be in this thing for quite a while. But if you look at energy stocks this week, actually not this week, but since the end, it's fallen by about 20%. So what does that tell you?
about the projection.
Yeah, we're getting you cutting out again. So try again. It lasts just about long enough to do a break. That's something. But we'll get you back right afterwards. Meanwhile, I got some things I want to talk about. There's some good news things and some bad news things, and just some common sense things. But overall, what do you expect for the market quickly next week? Oh, he's probably doing the restart. I'm thinking, like Adam, that it's going to be a close call up or down, but don't look for a skyrocket. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the trivia question is still out there. When Capital One had the huge breach in 2019, data breach, how many dollars per customer that was affected was their settlement, their direct settlement? They had a separate settlement with the government, but the settlement made with customers, how many dollars each? And we know that 300 is too high. I found, Adam, a reference to the people who do the GDP and the recession calling. I knew it started out with national something, but it's called the NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research. And it says they can look beyond real GDP figures when declaring a recession. They look at real income, employment, among other economic variables. And that means they're in control, which means my chances of being right about manipulation pretty much up there with 100%. And the PMI people, you probably know this from all the research you've been doing this week, but the PMI folks are showing that there's a very, very good chance that output is going to zero or falling. And we'll see, won't we? I lean your way, by the way. I believe that we are technically in one right now. But that's just me.
We'll see.
Yep, we will. All right, you said you had some housing data you want to bring up?
Yeah,
there were some weird numbers released this week.
There sure was. The often called housing bust doesn't seem like it's busting as planned. there was some interesting data this week, and it was actually fairly good for the housing industry. If you look at what's going on in the housing market, we're seeing prices still rising and mortgage costs increasing. So rates are increasing. So that is not a setup for increasing demand. But the May reading for new home sales came in at 696,000 annualized. Well, the forecast was for just 590,000 annualized, so 100,000 more. And last month, the reading was only at 591. So it actually increased by 100,000. That's
not a near miss, is it?
No, that's a blow it out of the water type number.
Yeah.
And mortgage applications actually rose for the second week in a row. So interesting stuff going on in the housing market. I did not expect to see numbers like that.
No, me neither. And especially, although, think about it. There's one thing that's going on. Anticipating higher prices and higher interest rates could be quite an incentive for people, a little push on their housing plans. So maybe
that's
it's
true.
Just that simple. And if so, that, of course, would be taking up sales from the future, which means when it falls, it's going to fall even a little bit harder or further than it would otherwise. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on, because it's a really, really big part of the consumer economy, which is, of course, 70% of the overall economy. So
yeah, historically,
we'll
mortgage rates still aren't high compared to where they've been in the past. They're high relative to
right. Recent
times, but not overall. So I think there'll be a period of adjustment while people get used to these new rates, and maybe that's what we're seeing. People are saying, oh, well, if we're going to pay 6%, that's what it is. We just have to figure out how to make that work.
Yeah, well, the millennials in particular are going into the housing market real big time right now, and they have never seen a real mortgage rate, what we call real, meaning the way I was growing up and even as an adult, and you, well, you were getting into your first homes. I don't know. What, do you remember what your first rate was?
It was somewhere around six. Okay. I can't remember exactly, but it was in. It was right around where they are right now.
Yeah. Okay. But that means that we have a generation of people out there who have never had to deal with this, and unfortunately, they're dealing with larger prices too. So it kind of a double whammy. It will find us equilibrium because that's what economics is all about. Okay. Now,
definitely.
You want some good news on a Saturday morning?
I would take some good news.
Good. It's from J.P. Morgan. And people have to realize why. We'll make it very clear as to why this is good news. J.P. Morgan says retail investors are finally bailing on stocks. How about that? They used the C word this week. Retail has capitulated. And until you see the word capitulated, or try to say it like I do, then it's not over yet. But this is really good news. When mom and pop start to sell their two shares of Home Depot that they bought because it was going up so fast, that means that the end is near. And the end is not the end of time. The end is the end of the market crash. So I thought I'd bring that to you. And you agree with that, I assume, because we sort of follow this sort of thing.
I do. It's typically a good sign. I still have a hard time envisioning more upside right now. It's probably more so than any other time since we started this business. It really doesn't look great out there. So, that may be true. I still would be on the side of there's a bit more pain to come.
And it wouldn't surprise me at all either.
And it does. It's a guess, but it just the economic picture right now, everything's headed the wrong direction. I don't love it.
No, and the worst part, yeah, I equate this back into the late 70s, early 80s, and I wrote myself a question that I can't answer this morning. It said, is this like the 80s? And in so many ways, it is like the early 80s. And that's when Volcker had to step in and bring us to a crashing halt, because the inflation rate was like 17% and interest rates were 20%. I think they got as high as 21 or 22. And obviously, as Mr. Stein would say, anything that's unsustainable will stop. Well, it did stop, but it was forced to stop sooner than it would otherwise, thank goodness, and we got back to normal. So we've got a difference. We had a Fed chief back then who understood what he had to do and how fast he had to do it. I'm not sure these people are cognizant like that. But there's more than that, because on January 20th of 1981, the election of 80 played out, and Reagan came in, and with that change came a dramatic change in policy. And we don't have that ability right now. We don't have the ability to make a new policy this year, next year, or the next year. It's going to take a long time. So in the absence of that, basically what Congress can do if the Congress gets taken over, and that's another subject that I won't even get into because it's too long and ugly, but assuming that the Republican Party takes over the Congress again, they can put the brakes on some of what's going on, but they can't actually change the policy. And that means to me it is not exactly like the 80s. Yeah, then the sub-question, I guess, would be, so what will happen because it's not like that? And I haven't figured that part out either. This is a very, very confusing time to try to make a forecast, short-term, mid-term, or long-term. So, yeah. I don't know.
Argument is that the brakes are already on because there's no meaningful economic spending bills or anything like that getting through the current Congress. So I just don't see that as being a catalyst to rev up the market. So I don't know where it would come from right now, and that's part of my reason for being more pessimistic than I normally am.
So you don't think that the big push for more windmills is going to solve the problem for us? Is that what you're saying?
I don't see that being a viable way out. I don't know. Call me crazy.
I have many times, but not today and not on that one, that's for sure. Oh, well, I got a few seconds here. The Secure 2.0 update of the week. There have been a couple of them. The Senate, both Senate committees passed them. They're merging, and they are hustling through it as fast as they can because they know they're going to start from scratch if they don't get it through this Congress and get it passed. One thing that bothers me is that they're not going to, it appears they're not going to fix the 10-year rule that needs to be fixed, and I'll explain this after the break. But Ron Wyden, and he's as wacky as they come, he has one line in this article that I can't stand. I think I'll just hold it until after the break, do a little teaser. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do have our trivia questions still open. In 2019, when Capital One saw a great big breach of customer data, and I mean really big, I'll start to give you a little more information now. That's 100 million customers were affected, and it included such things as their home address and Social Security numbers. What they made a settlement, Capital One made a settlement with their customers. How many dollars per person were involved in that settlement? And we know that 300 is too high. All right. The Secure 2.0. People who listen to the show regularly know that I have a personal interest in this, of course, but there are many, many features that affect a lot more people also. And fundamentally, one of the biggest things for all younger people, and for this purpose, younger means you were born after June 30th of 1949, so some of you even have numbers that start with 7 like me. We're bumping up, if this passes, we bump up the required minimum distribution age, which has already been bumped from 70 and a half to 72. This would take it to 73. 5 more years, it would be 70, or it would be 78, and then it'd be 83. What? Right, 73, 78, 83, and that would take 10 years to fully implement. So that's one thing, but there are many others, and not everything in this is good. One of the things I don't like is that they're going to require all catch-up contributions to IRAs. And for those of you who aren't there yet or don't understand that, people who are 50 and older can make catch-up contributions over and above the normal person's contribution. So today, the IRA limit for everyone is $6,000 a year. And then if you're allowed a catch-up contribution, you can do an extra one. Well, all of those are going to have to be Roth. Now, every catch-up contribution is going to have to be Roth-style, meaning it's taxable to you before you put it in. And I am not crazy about that one. It is a revenue generator, but not to the people.
I don't like that at all.
No, I don't either. And then, this is the comment that really bugs me, and I'll tell you a little more about why. Ron Wyden said, quote, "This bill is fully paid for." And when I hear a leftist senator from Wackoville say that something is fully paid for, I look in the mirror and say, what is he not telling us?
Yeah, where is that extra revenue coming from?
Yeah, you think that's enough, that just the Roth part of the IRA contributions to offset another year of not taking RMDs and then later in life to do even more? What is it that we don't know yet? And I promise you, the second I find it, it'll be on the show the next Saturday. As I'm looking through everything that comes in about it, this has me a little bit concerned. As much as I like the good things, it bugs me. It looks like we have a call coming in, but I don't have a name yet. Oh, there it is.
I wonder also, would then Roth and traditional funds be commingled in one 401k, and you would have to track each? That that seems very challenging.
Well, yeah, and this bill, the summary of the bill I'm reading, which, of course, is worth what I paid for it, it only says IRA, so I don't even know about qualified plans.
Oh, okay.
So we'll see. Huh. Anyway, good morning, Bosco.
Good morning, y'all. Another great, great program.
Thank you. I heard you were out riding around this morning.
I was kind of...
That's
kind of tooling.
Yeah, he's on a bicycle.
That table muscle, you know.
Uh-huh. What's happening?
I want to take a stab.
Sure.
And then a question. So I was thinking down around $100. Let's say $100.
All right. Too high.
Oh.
Yeah. Shocking, huh?
Well, seriously. Curiosity here. Is there any way that you can kind of, you know, ballpark evaluate if a stock is overpriced? I'm sure there's a lot more than, you know, just simply looking at a.
Adam, you want to address?
Sorry about that.
Traffic is booming this morning.
You can do a valuation. That's really loud. You can do a
Maybe we should answer this off air. Because we're not getting.
Yeah.
We're not getting. If that's okay, Bosco, just keep listening and we'll talk about it for a bit. And
thank you
for the
call.
Oh, much better. All right, carry on.
Okay, so you can do a valuation on any stock at any time, and it will give you a valuation. The determination of whether it's over or undervalued is that's the more challenging question, because if you were to ask the same question and run the same valuation a year ago, you might find that something was undervalued. But in today's conditions, you might determine that it's overvalued, and it could be the same value. It's whatever the market is putting the valuation at is where the stock will trade. So you can come up with a valuation, but you don't know what the market is going to determine as far as whether or not that's over or undervalued compared to its current price. So it's a really tricky question without a real answer. It's more of an art form than a science, especially in conditions like these.
Yeah, if you read the literature, they're going to tell you it's the discounted cash flow value of future projected dividends. Well, yeah, that's well and good, isn't it? But that gives you a number, and it gives you something to go from. But there is systematic risk. There is asystematic risk. There is risk of every kind of thing you can think of, from foreign currency to industry. You know, right now, you would think, and you'd be wrong, you would think that the industry of clean energy would be hot. It's not. If you look at the clean energy ETFs, they're losing, and have been since Biden got elected, which is absolutely counterintuitive to me. So that's the kind of risk that's in the market that you can't really account for.
No, and also we've seen a lot of PE multiple compression recently. So what used to be, so tech stocks used to trade at a price to earnings ratio that was much higher than what they are today. And nothing has fundamentally changed about their businesses. They're not making there are some that are making less money, some that are making more money, but in general, nothing has really changed except that the market is putting a different value on their earnings than it did even a year ago. So when you see things like that, which is what I was referring to with a year ago, you might say something looked cheap and now it looks expensive. The market is valuing it differently than it was a year ago. So it's not a static answer to say, oh, I ran a discounted cash flow model and this is undervalued. It changes constantly, and there's a lot of variables that go into that, including one of the biggest ones is interest rates. So you have to factor all those in, look at what its peers are trading at,
and then also apply a little bit of your own common sense to your model and say, this is what I think is going to happen going forward. This is the reason we don't try to value individual stocks and trade individual stocks, because it is so difficult to get that the answer to that question right. And more often than not, even when you think you have it right, you don't.
Here's a little Clark Howard goodie. We love Clark Howard. I give him credit for all the stuff I ever quote him on, and he's very amusing sometimes. He says there's three places you never should invest. Number one, never invest with a bank. Two, where else should you never go? An insurance company. Three, and the last place you shouldn't go, any bank-affiliated brokerage. He says, quote, because it's not as bad as doing one of these things directly with a bank. It's just almost as bad. So where do you go? You go to Fidelity, Schwab, somebody like that, and you get a fee-only fiduciary. Maybe that's one of the reasons I like Clark so much. He's so smart. That just hit me because most of the stockbrokers spend their time trying to put a value on a stock and making a portfolio out of individual things that can make a mistake. All right, $80 million was paid to the government by Capital One. And by the way, the breach person worked for Amazon and the web services. They settled for, I rounded up to $2. The actual was $1.94. What a bargain. That said, thanks for listening. See you next week. This is the Banway Financial Hour.